Hello, Dental Online Trainers, and welcome to the Dental Online Training Sharecast. I'm your host, Dr. Dennis Hartlieb. Each month, I'll be talking with dental experts who are doing amazing work in the field of dentistry and talk about how they got to be where they are today, what their influences were, and their journey in the world of dentistry. And as a bonus, I'll occasionally throw in a few of my solo bonding sharecasts, where I share a little of my experience with you about what's going on in my practice and lessons that I've learned along the way. So tune in every other week to hear our latest episode. Hello, Dental Online Trainers. I'm Dr. Dennis Hartlieb, back with you again today for another of our Sharecast episodes. Today, I have the great pleasure of hanging out with one of my great friends. This is Dr. Bill Robbins, and I want to talk about him because if you know Bill, Bill's not the kind of guy who's going to talk about himself. So I want to introduce him because if I were to introduce him, he'd just say, oh, he's just this little old dentist down in Texas. So I want to tell you a little bit more about him so you can understand why I wanted him to be on our Sharecast. Beyond being an incredible dentist, he's one of the best educators I've ever seen in my 35 years of learning dentistry. And beyond that, he's just like one of the most incredible humans, which I think is like kind of a nice thing these days to actually find incredible humans. I don't know how we compare to other species on the planets, but as a human, I think he's pretty high up there, you know, as a cat or a dog, I'm not sure, but as a human, he's pretty darn good. In today's episode, you're used to the Sharecast. We're going to talk about his background, but let me tell you a little bit about his accomplishments in dentistry, because he just won't tell you. He's co-authored a couple books. One of the way I got introduced to Bill was through what he calls a global diagnosis, and his book is Global Diagnosis, A New Vision of Dental Diagnosis and Treatment Planning. And then he has a previous book, I think it's on like its fourth edition now, Fundamentals of Operative Dentistry, A Contemporary Approach. And if anyone's written a book, I have not, because I can barely get reading through a book, but to actually write a book, I think that's an accomplishment like Mount Everest, and to do two is incredible. He's authored over 80 articles and publications, which is just incredible. He's attained many awards, Presidential Teaching Award at University of Texas Health Sciences Center. Well, I want to talk to you more about that in a little bit. He was 2002 Texas Dentist of the Year. This is awkward, isn't it, when people talk to you about like this? It's like being present at your own funeral and someone's reading off your eulogy, but you should hear it. He was the Thaddeus Weddell Fellowship Award from the AGD. I love saying this, the Saul Schlager Award from the Seattle Study Club. That's just so cool to say. He won the Academy of Operative Dentistry Award of Excellence. He is past president of the American Board of General Dentistry, the Academy of Operative Dentistry, the Southwest Academy of Restorative Dentistry, and my favorite organization, the American Academy of Restorative Dentistry. Bill, what do you do in your spare time?
That's a question my wife asks me often.
So that's Bill. And if you don't know Bill, I would tell you the way that you need to get introduced to him is the same way that I did, was through his global diagnosis stuff. So Bill, thank you for joining us. I'm so grateful that you're spending a little time with us and let's talk about how it all started.
Well, thanks, Dennis. It is indeed a pleasure to be with you tonight. And I have the same affection for you that you do for me. We've been friends for actually quite a long time.
Yeah.
And also our careers have run somewhat parallel. I mean, we're both general dentists. We've got an interest in teaching restorative dentistry and aesthetic dentistry. And so, I mean, it's been fun to sort of run along hand in hand in this journey that we've done together. So thanks so much for having me today. It's a real pleasure.
So, Bill, I know a little bit about where you've been lately, but I don't know how it all started. So where'd you grow up?
So my story is actually, it's interesting to me. I don't know if it'll be to everybody else, but I grew up in a dental family. I grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, and my father was a dentist who practiced in Little Rock. I had two uncles who practiced in smaller towns outside of Little Rock, and my grandfather was a dentist. And so I was third generation dentist, and back in those days, a lot of times people, dentists would have their homes and offices together. That's what we had. So I lived in the upstairs with my family at the downstairs to the dental office. And so I hung out all my formative years. I hung out with my dad. He was a great man. He was fun to be with, and the patient loved it. And I grew up in a dental world. And when I was in dental school, when I would go hang out with him in the summer, he was kind of a dentist for blue-collar people. He did lots of extractions and dentures and so on. And he'd be working on one of his old mechanic, you know, patients or something. He'd walk out of the room, and I'd be standing there, and they'd say, "So, son, you making a dentist?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I'm going to dental school." They'd say, "If you're half the dentist your dad is, you'll be a hell of a dentist." And I heard that a lot growing up, and it always made me feel so good to know how much his patients appreciated him. And so it's been a great run. There was no pressure for me to go to dental school. It was just what you do, you know? That's what my dad did, and he was happy doing it. So I always knew that I was going to go to dental school. And so,
did you have siblings?
Got into.
Do you have siblings?
I have one sister.
And did she go into dentistry?
No. She's the intellectual one of the family. She got a PhD, became a world expert in neurolinguistics, and taught as a professor for many years.
So cool. So yeah. Looking back, your dad being a dentist, people being just at beck and call. He was at beck and call. He's upstairs from the dental practice. I have to imagine people came in on the weekends. People came over in the evenings to, you know, "Hey, Doc Robbins." So did he just take that all in stride? Did your mom take that all in stride? Was this just sort of like how it was? Or was there friction when you're just so like 24/7 on demand?
No, I wouldn't say there was so much friction. It was funny. My mother was a very strong individual, very artistic. She was an amazing lady. We could talk all day about my mother. She outlived my father by 25 years. Wow. But she was a registered nurse, and they met during World War II in San Francisco, moved back to Arkansas, and she had the idea that she was going to help him in the office. And so one day she was in the office with him. He was doing a denture setup, you know, as they did back then. He was setting the teeth. They'd try it in, and they'd pull it out and move a tooth around. And she said, "You know, this is too straight. You need to put an angle here and an angle." But I mean, she was directing where to put the teeth, and he turned around and glared at her, and she turned around and stopped out, and she never went back in the dental office again. So she had her world, he had his world, and it was a wonderful I grew up in a wonderful family. It was a great raising that I had, but she knows she had no interest in dentistry. She got fed up with that pretty quickly.
So when you went to undergrad, you were going there so that you could get there to go to dental school. Was that sort of like, you knew you wanted to be a dentist, and this was just an inroad to get to dental school?
Yes, that's true. But there was also one little overlay that people my age remember pretty clearly, and that is Vietnam War. And I graduated from high school in 1967. Mm-hmm. And that's when the Vietnam War was really starting to ramp up. I was in pre-dental at the University of Arkansas. And after 2.5 years in 1969 was when they first had the draft where they were picking balls out of the hopper. Mm-hmm. And you'd get a number.
Yep.
If you had a low number, you'd get drafted. Well, that was my time. I was in my third year pre-dental. And being pre-dental didn't keep you out of right. Military. Being in dental school did, but not pre-dental. And I got into dental school after 3 years of college. And I got in like in December, and they had the drawing in January. And I had a low number. So I very likely would have either gone to Vietnam or joined, you know, the guard or do something
right.
To try to stay out of Vietnam. But I was very lucky, and by a month I got into dental school. And so, you know, I always knew I wanted to be a dentist, but I was glad that the timing worked out because I really had no interest in going to Vietnam. So it was kind of a twofer there.
You know, I'm younger than that. And yeah. So my uncles were influenced by this. My brothers are younger also. For our listeners who are just, you know, aware of the Vietnam War, talk about like what was going on the campus and stuff like that. What was going on around your world as the war was heating up and as the draft was picking up and stuff? What was it like?
Yeah, it was a tumultuous time, that's for sure. And right around 1969, 1970, and then on for another 2 or 3 years, 4 years, it was really in its heyday of anti-war activism. I'm a little ashamed or embarrassed to say I really wasn't involved in it. I wish I had been more involved in it. I was trying to get into dental school, and I was not the sharpest tool shed. And I mean, I literally had to work for every grade I got. It all came very, it was difficult for me. Undergraduate was in some ways more difficult than dental school. So I was all about work. I mean, getting through algebra and chemistry and physics and all was all I could do. So I really wasn't involved. It was all swirling around me, but I had my head down then trying to get enough, good enough grades to get into dental school.
I'm so glad you say that. So many people I talk to, I struggled. I went to Michigan undergrad and I worked my tail off. We studied every weekend. I mean, we'd go to the football game and then we would be studying maybe before, depending on what time the game was, but we would be studying after the game. And I'd be studying on Sundays. We studied every night of the week. I mean, I worked my tail off. Yep. So it's reassuring to hear there's someone else out there who had such a difficult time like I did, because it was every, and so I get it completely about just putting your head down and just, I mean, because that was my thing too. I just worried about getting into dental school and world politics. I just didn't have any, I had to just keep going.
I mean, looking back, obviously it would have been a point of pride to have been involved in that, but I wasn't. So I can't claim any high ground when it comes to that. I was just trying to bungle down and get it done.
You end up going to Tennessee for dental school, if I remember right.
That's right. Yeah. So I went to University of Arkansas for 3 years, and then I got in at Tennessee, which is in Memphis, and it was 3 years also back then, the three-year dental school. So I graduated from dental school. I turned 24 like a month before I graduated from dental school, so I was pretty young.
You're a baby.
And when I was in my last year of dental school, I just assumed that I was going to go work with my father at Little Rock. He had an office big enough for me. And that's what you did 50 years ago. You went in with your dad.
Yep.
And when I was toward the end of my third year, one day we were talking, he said, I've been reading about something called a dental internship, and I think you ought to do one. And I said, I've never heard of it. What is it? And he said, well, it's an extra year that you do after you graduate from dental school. You go to a VA hospital. They'll teach you a lot. And then after that, if you want, you can come home and go to work with me. And I said, well, I guess. I mean, back in those days, you did what your dad told you to do. What do I do? And he said, you go to the VA there in Memphis and apply for their program. So I went and applied, and I didn't get in there, but I got in at a program in Leavenworth, Kansas. So I told my dad, I don't really want to go to the VA in Leavenworth, Kansas. That doesn't sound very appealing. He said, yeah, go do it. It's just a year. It'll be good for you. You'll grow up some. You'll learn a lot of dentistry. Go do it. Then if you want to come back, you can. Well, I said, okay. So I went and did this 1 year. Now it's called a GPR. Back then they call it an internship. And I just loved it. It was the richest educational experience of my life. I learned so much, and I was the only GPR. There were other specialty residents there, but I was the only general dentistry one. And I just loved it. And when I finished it, I had to pay a year back. That's the way it was back then. And so I paid the year back. And during my second year, I decided that I wanted to do more. And they just started a two-year general practice residency in the VA. So I applied and got into the one in San Diego. So I moved from Kansas to San Diego, which was a fun move. And then I did a two-year GPR. And when I finished that program, I had to pay two years back for that. And that's how I ended up in San Antonio. They offered, there's like four different hospitals that had spots that I could move to, and three of them were terrible. And the one good one was San Antonio. There was one other resident with me, and I was a better resident, so I got first choice, and so I picked San Antonio. And so that's how I got back to where I've lived most of my life since. And, I'll always be grateful to my father, because once I got back to San Antonio to the VA, I started teaching. There's a GPR already started at that VA. So I started teaching in that, and very quickly I became director of it. So early in my career, I became a director of a general practice residency. And by that time, I was booked in academics and I never went home. And my dad gave me, the freedom to pursue what I wanted to do. And he would have loved to have practiced with me. I mean, it would have been a wonderful experience. but he gave me this freedom to fly, and I never went home. So I've got a lot of gratitude for my parents for many reasons, but one, perhaps one of the most, is that my dad put me on this track that has impacted my career literally for all 51 years that I've been practicing.
That's awesome. I want to unreel a couple things. So the first thing is, what I'm always curious about, people who grew up with their parents being a dentist and being surrounded, and you were like embedded in this, and then you go to dental school, and I have to assume at dental school they're teaching things differently than what your dad was practicing.
For sure.
And so I always wonder, what was that like as a young dental student? And on one hand, the person that you most admire, your father, you've been under his wing, you've been learning, you know, elbow to elbow, and then you go to dental school and you're hearing things differently. Tell me about how that felt. If you look back at that, what do you remember?
You know, I still have mostly positive memories about it, more funny than anything. Because like I said, my dad was no state-of-the-art dentist. That's not who he was. He was a dentist of the blue collar. And I remember just before I went to dental school, he said, when you get there, they're going to teach you to use something called a rubber dam. And I'd never seen it before because he didn't use it. And he pulled out a big old roll of rubber dam, and he was going to pull a piece off and cut it for me. And it was so old that it would rot. And so we both laughed about that. And so when I went to dental school, I mean, obviously I was learning things differently than what he was doing in his practice, but it just didn't seem to make that much difference to me, honestly, because I still looked up to him. I still knew how much his patients loved him. I knew he was a dentist to the blue collar people. And I didn't have a vision that I would be doing what I'm doing today. Mm-hmm. I had no vision at all. I just assumed I'd go back and, you know,
just do the same dentistry.
And so it really provided no discomfort or any, because we hunted and fished a lot together. So when we were together, we did talk about dentistry some, but we did a lot of other fun things together. And one other memory I have is when I was doing my 1 year internship in Leavenworth, Kansas. I was just all full of spit and vinegar. And that's when Ramus implants were going
sure.
in.
Yep.
You know, four things where you drill a hole and you tap them in. So
fine.
I put in a couple of those. And I was doing, you know, hot shot dentistry in this program. And we were at the farm. My dad and my uncles were all farmers. My granddad, they loved the farm more than dentistry. And we're at the farm one weekend. And we all started talking, and man, I just started going off about all this cool dentistry I was doing. And I know all three of them were thinking, you know, he is so full of crap. He doesn't even know nothing about what he doesn't know. But they all three were so kind to me that specific time I'll never forget. And they were all just excited for me and enthused for me. And they could have just, you know, slammed me for being so stupid because I didn't have a hint as to what I was talking about. But I had only a supportive family from beginning to end. Uncles, grandfather, everybody was supportive.
That's wonderful. For those who aren't aware, so the first implants, I remember seeing the surgeries at Michigan when I was there. They would do sort of transmandibular implants. They would do an incision on the gingival crest. It was almost like a nut and bolt type operation. The implant would go all the way through the mandible. They'd do an incision on the bottom of the chin. And then they would connect the implant with almost like a little nut on the bottom. And those were before, or maybe it was running parallel to the endosseous implants, but yep. maybe just a little bit ahead of that. And that's what I remember seeing as the first implants when I was at dental school.
Yeah, those transmandibular implants were wild.
Yeah.
The wounds coming after your chin. Holy cow.
Yeah. That brings me back.
Yeah.
Sure. So I'm curious, you said you have to pay back a year. So when I did my GPR, I got paid a really small stipend, and I did my GPR in Chicago. But you said you had to pay back a year. So explain that, because I don't understand that.
Well, they had two tracks in the VA back in those days. And this is literally 50 years ago. I graduated from dental school in 1973. So this is my 51st year of practice.
Was anesthetic invented in 1974?
Yeah, barely. Yeah, we were just putting ether into a So back in those days, they had what's called a career and a non-career track. And the career track meant that you had to pay a year back, but you got paid a lot more. So this is 1973. I got paid $15,000 a year as a resident. So it was an amazing amount of
That's great.
Than I had to pay a year back.
And then you had to pay a year back, meaning that you had to give one more year of service.
That's right, one more year of service.
But you were paid for it both years.
Yes, correct. And I was paid both years, yeah. In fact, I got a significant raise the second year when I became a staff dentist. Yeah.
When I did my GPR in Chicago, I got paid $17,000. That was 1988, 89.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely a good salary for 1973, 75 for sure.
What do you remember when you're at that first VA that just lit your fire about? Well, I guess I have a question before that. So you're in dental school, and what I found interesting when you're talking was when you did your residency, that's when it like exploded for you.
Yes.
So what was different about dental school versus the residency from like, what was it about the residency that lit your fire that you didn't get in dental school?
Yeah, I didn't have any great passion for dentistry when I went into it. You know, I just saw my dad happy at it, and I figured I would be too. I had no great passion to be a dentist. And really, at dental school, it was hard also. I mean, mm-hmm. I just hunkered down. And again, I definitely wasn't any close to the smartest guy in my class. And so I worked hard to get through, and I did reasonably well. I certainly went to the top of my class. But again, I'm not smart, but I work hard. And I was a hard worker at dental school, but it was all about getting requirements done. I mean, it was all about, you know, going places. You had to find your own patients, you know.
Yeah.
Going to a bar, going someplace and finding patients. And so I was all about trying to get out of dental school. So dental school was a chore. But when I got in the residency program, the patients were all there. There was nobody, they didn't have to pay for anything. They'd already earned it with their service. And I jumped into doing sophisticated dentistry. And I was there with all these other programs. There was an endo program, graduate program. There was a PROS program. There's a perio program. And I'm the only young general practice resident kind of guy. And I'm with all these older people that are doing residency programs at OMS. And so I think what turned me on was how talented the people were that were teaching me. These were all very talented specialists, more so than you would get at dental school, I would say.
Sure.
And so, I don't know, it just turned it on for me. And that first year changed my whole trajectory.
Do you think they were just more willing to share? They treated, because you were, you were an equal amongst them. So were they just more open to sharing, do you think, than what, like your dental experience was just like more of a grind? And now you got people who are just want to share with you what they're doing, what they're learning and stuff?
Yeah, I was by far the youngest there, even of the residents. But, you know, when the perio residents would all be, they were 3, 4, 5, 6 years older than mm-hmm. me. And the staff that was there, I mean, as you know, with your years of being around education, there are some specialists that really enjoy teaching general dentists and want them to succeed. And there's other specialists that don't. I mean, they don't think they should be doing it. I'll tell you a little more story about that as we get into my son, who just graduated from dental school 6 months ago.
Oh, I did not know.
So I had a group of specialists that were well-selected to teach in a general practice residency because they wanted to teach young general dentists how to do what they did.
Yeah.
And so I think it was because there was such a strong faculty there that were just so willing to help me. And I was the only GPR. I was the only one. And so I got a lot of personal attention. And it was just a magic time in my life. And then when I went and did the two-year program, it was equally good. It was just more sophisticated. So there were 4 residents. We were there for 2 years. So there were 2 in my class, 2 in the second year class. And we had an oral surgeon, a periodontist, a prosthodontist, an endodontist. And I was there all the time, one-on-one, doing procedures with a specialist. So it still informs everything I do today, not only clinically, but even more so the thinking process that I gained by hanging around really smart specialists that were willing to share their treatment plan skills with me. That was a real important part for me.
Now, were you married at the time when you were doing in dental school and going through residency and stuff?
Well, I was single the whole time.
Yeah.
And then when I moved back to San Antonio, 6 months after I got to San Antonio for that payback at the VA, I met my wife. We dated a couple of years and got married. We've been married now for 44 years. So I got married right after I finished all of my training. So it was perfect timing.
Perfect timing. How'd you like San Diego?
I love San Diego. And in fact, I would have stayed there if there'd been a spot. There wasn't an opening at that hospital, you know, for somebody to stay. The next year there was, and the resident stayed there and he did his whole career there. So I'm very likely to have stayed in the VA longer If I'd ended up in San Diego, I loved it. I bought a little house. The first house I bought, it was a half a block off the beach. The only piece of real estate I owned.
Yeah.
San Diego was a home run for sure.
And how did those Californians treat someone with a Southern accent, like I'm sure that you had when you rolled in?
It was really funny. And I mean, I still have a pretty significant accent. You can imagine it was even more so back
I
then.
Bet.
But I grew up in Arkansas, which is Tennessee, so everybody spoke the same. We all sounded the same. So I didn't really get a sense of how bad my accent was until I got to San Diego. And I'll never forget, this was a GPR, so it was a hospital program. So the first time I went to the OR and finished up, my attending said, now you need to dictate into a dictaphone your op report. And he said, after you finish it, then rewind it and listen to it. Make sure you said what you want to say. Well, I dictated this op report. I rewound it and listened to it. And I mean, I sounded like the caricature of a country bumpkin. And it was the first time that I realized how country I really sounded. I didn't really think about it, but yeah, it was people loved to listen to me. And I thought it because, you know, I was clever.
Really interesting. You thought you were interesting.
Yeah, it wasn't any of that. It was strictly my country cornbone accent that they enjoyed.
I wish everyone knew the reference to Gomer Pyle, but I'll throw it out there. Oh, golly.
Golly. I've always said my whole lecture career, if I had a British accent, I would have gone a long ways in my career. Because when you have a Southern accent like mine, you automatically, the moment you open your mouth in front of a study club, your IQ drops 10 points. And you spend the rest of the day trying to get back up to where you started. And if you start with a British accent, right off the bat, it's plus 10. You know, so it is what it is. But if I'd had a British accent, I think I could have been famous, Dennis.
I think that's 90% of Jason Smithson's success, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt. That's for sure.
There was a comedian who talked about, you know, you could be the world's most brilliant physicist, but as soon as you say, well, the electron goes round and round and round the atom, you just lose all credibility. And so I think there's something to be said about that.
For sure.
So you ended up in San Antonio, and you're running the GPR program. And yeah. Then how'd you get into private practice?
Right. Well, I had another couple of stops to make before private practice. So I was in the VA for a total of 9 years. And so that means I was at the VA at San Antonio for 5 years. And after 4 of those years, I was kind of getting tired of it. I'd done it. I was working hard. I was worn out. And I wanted an adventure in my life. And so I went to my wife and said, I'd like to go live in Europe. And she said, yeah, yeah. And so I went, the Air Force command, if you will, that assigned dentists in San Antonio. So I went out and had an interview with the colonel that did all the picking of dentists in the Air Force, and interviewed to join the Air Force. And I told him my graduation year, and he said, you know, I'm sorry, but we don't have anything available in your graduation year. And I said, all right, let's start over again. I did a 1 year, a 2 year GPR, and I got the Federal Service Board of General Dentistry. And he goes, so where do you want to go? Changed the whole conversation. And I said, I want to go to Europe. And he said, how about Germany? And I said, perfect. He said, how about Ramstein? I said, I've heard of it. I'll go there. When do you want to go? Tomorrow? And I said, no, I need 6 months. And so we quit the VA. My wife and I moved to Germany, joined the Air Force, moved to Germany. We were there for 2.5 years, and they curtailed my assignment. I would have stayed 4, 5, or 6. I loved living in Europe, but they brought me back then to teach in the 2 year general AEG pro. It was a GPR back then at Wilford Hall. The Air Force Dental School, if you will, is in San Antonio, where all the residencies are. Perio Prof. The 2 year AZD program was also in San Antonio. So I became co-director of that program and spent 2 more years as co-director of that program. And then I quit the Air Force after 5 years and went to the dental school in San Antonio. And I ran the AGD program there for a dozen years. So that was the first 25 years of my practice. I was primarily institutional academic dentistry for 25 years. And then in 1997, I started phasing out of the dental school and went to full-time private practice in 2000.
How much dentistry were you doing as when you're running these programs, give us some insights into first when you're running the residency program down at UT, and then you go off to Germany. How much of it are you doing dentistry? How much of it are you doing teaching? How does that all work?
Well, so when I was at the VA, running the GPR and doing dentistry, I was doing a lot of both. So I was doing a lot of dentistry, but I was also running the program. So that was really busy. I then went to Germany, and it was just like a vacation because I was just a staff dentist in Germany. I had no responsibility except to go in the morning and do dentistry all day and leave. So it was very easy. It was like a long vacation. And then I went back to Lackland. So I did a lot of dentistry along the way. And then I went back to Lackland to teach in the two-year program there. And I did some dentistry, but I did a lot of teaching. We had 8 or 16 residents. And so I spent a lot of time teaching clinical dentistry. So I wasn't doing it much. I then went to the dental school and I was involved in a faculty practice, but that's a day a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat out with the residents a lot and taught, but I wasn't doing a ton of dentistry. And when I left the dental school, I had a pretty high opinion of myself as a clinical dentist because I was the guy at dental school that the faculty would all send their wives and all to. I was dentist for the dentist at the dental school. Mm-hmm. So I thought I was pretty good. But when I went to private practice and started seeing, a dozen patients a day and having the pressure of the practice, I realized I wasn't near as good as I thought. And it's true. It was one of the most humbling times of my life. The first 3 years after I left academics and went into private practice were three of the most difficult years of my life because I wasn't near as good clinically as I had assumed that I was. Because when you cherry pick a case, and you spend hours doing it and you photograph it, no pressure. That's a way different situation than a patient that's paying significant fees and you got to do it in a limited amount of time. So yeah, I'm very humbling going into private practice the first few years for sure.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. I have to imagine, and I don't have a lot of experience with the military. I have friends who've done that. And I know that it's sort of a set schedule and I know there's a limited number of patients. And so I was curious, when you get into private practice, I think beyond the fact now you're dealing with people who are paying, that adds a whole different, psychological element to it, emotional element to it, and plus the scheduling. Did you have anyone to guide you through that process or were you just trying to figure it out? You're on your own, or what was that like?
Well, so the good news is that when I left the dental school, I went into practice with Jeff Ralph. Jeff's name. And Jeff was one of my dental students, actually, at the dental school in San Antonio. And we were made friends. And when I left the dental school, I went into practice as an associate in his practice. And so I learned quite a bit from him. But we were only together about 4 years. And then he left and went off and did PROS. And so I was on my own. And it was a very difficult time. My wife and I essentially were starting this private practice from scratch. I was totally ill-equipped in all ways. I knew how to do dentistry, but I was totally ill-equipped in leadership. I was totally ill-equipped in management. I didn't have any systems. I didn't know how to set systems up. So my wife and I struggled for a couple of years trying to, cash flow and new hires and all the issues associated with starting a practice. And eventually the pain was great enough that we hired a consultant. We couldn't afford it. It was a giant sum of money for us. We had no money. And now you got to go out and hire a consultant. And we did that. And it was brilliant. It was for us, it was absolutely the right thing to do. Because once we got a consultant, then we were on a path. We were on a path to developing systems in the office. And we were on a path to developing some key practice indicators. We're on a path to getting a cash flow that allowed us to take our breath. So yeah, the first few years in private practice were very difficult for both my wife and I. But you get through it, and it turned out good in the end.
Do you remember talking to your dad about these struggles when you were when you go through them?
Not really, because by the time I did that, my dad was ill. My dad actually died soon after I moved back to San Antonio. So he got to see me go through my residency program and, run a residency program. And he was really proud of that, but he never saw me in private practice.
I have a lot of gratitude for what I learned at Michigan and for my years at Marquette Dental School teaching and stuff. And I know the dental schools work hard, and I have friends who are in academics and stuff, and I know they work incredibly hard. But there are some things that you just cannot teach in a class. There are things that take so much more experience and so much more time and mentorship. And bringing on a coach, for instance, is such a big deal. And I can remember in my practices, it all seems like glory, right? Everyone thinks you're like the rich dentist and stuff. But the reality is that we are, most of us, and maybe it's changing today, but I think back then, most of us were ill-equipped for leadership, for management. I think, organizational health and organizational structures. Like you talk about, just having systems in place, which seemed absurd to me. Like, this is not General Motors. We're not McDonald's. We don't need to have systems. But the reality is that you must have systems, right, to have organizational health.
And I agree with you. I don't even think it's the dental school's job to teach these things. Lord knows there's not enough time to teach what they need to learn now. There's no time for real leadership, for real management. It's just not what dental school's about. And in fact, there's not really much time to teach anything other than single tooth dentistry. And that's the reason I'm such a fan of doing at least a 1-year AGD program or GPR when you get out. That's what I always counsel dental students to do. I mean, if there's any way financially you can afford to do one more year, it will impact your life forever if you do. And I now teach one day a week in the AGD program at the dental school. So I'm back, I'm sort of circling back at the end of my career back to teaching again. And I just love being there. The residents, they're all smart. I mean, they're so smart. They're so talented. And all they need is mentorship. All they need is somebody to sit down and show them. Any problem, in my opinion, related to the quality of young dentists today when they get out of dental school is not related to the students. It's related to the educational system. It's just very difficult today to attract enough faculty with what faculty are paid. It's very difficult to attract enough faculty to do a really quality dental school like I think you and I had, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Without question.
It's a very difficult time for dental education. And I've got a great deal of respect for those that are there, for the educators that are there, because they're doing a yeoman's job and they're not getting paid very much.
No.
Our profession owes them a ton of gratitude, which they don't get. So they not only don't get gratitude, but they don't get paid either. So I think I've got real concerns about dental education for sure.
And I think the other thing I tell people all the time that when I was in school, so I graduated in 88, I had to learn an inch of material a mile deep. I had to know everything about amalgam. I had to know everything about gold. I had to know about creepage of amalgam, and they had to know everything. But the reality is today, there's so many materials. There's so much information to know that students today have to learn a mile of information, but they can only learn it an inch deep. And so unfortunately, I think that most of the students, not all, but many of the students come in into private practice unprepared, which again, I think is such a value of some sort of, continuing ed program like an AEGD or an AGD or something formalized to help give you that next step and help give you more reps and more information about the techniques that are currently going on in dentistry.
For sure. I totally echo what you're saying. Dentistry was so much simpler back when we were in school. I mean, it didn't mean it wasn't any harder. Dental school was really hard, but
brutal.
It was simpler. And now it's really hard. It's equally hard now, but it's very complicated. And, I just don't think that there's enough time in a dental school curriculum to even prepare a young dentist to practice. That's why I'm such a proponent of at least a 1-year program afterwards. I just think it makes a giant difference in their lives to spend one more year.
Hey, Dental Online trainers, just so you know, this is actually a 2-part interview with Dr. Bill Robbins. If you enjoyed the first part of our conversation, then please join us in just a couple of weeks for the second part of the interview. You can watch this full episode on YouTube or subscribe wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts. Again, thanks for listening. Yours for better dentistry. I'm Dr. Dennis Hartlieb. Well, thanks so much for listening or viewing our Sharecast today. If you enjoy this and you want to get more information from Dental Online Training, then check us out at dothandson.com. That's one word, dothandson.com. And hey, be sure to share this with your friends and colleagues, anyone who you think might benefit from this Sharecast. And please be sure to leave us a 5-star review if you enjoyed our conversation. This podcast is edited by Luna Clark and includes original music by Chris Peterson. And again, thank you for listening. Yours for better dentistry, I'm Dr. Dennis Hartlieb.